This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to talk about back to school, what it might look like for K through 12 students this fall. Some districts are releasing their plans, and they all look a little bit different. But first, one big question about this pandemic is how long will it take to develop a COVID-19 vaccine? There are lots of candidates and clinical trials happening. The National Institutes of Health is running a trial created by the company Moderna. The results were published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine. Here to give us an update on that vaccine trial and other science headlines from the week is Annalee Newitz, science writer and author based out of San Francisco. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. This vaccine has been tested in people and passed through phase one trials. So please tell us what that means.
So what that means is that the vaccine was tested on a small group. In this case, it was 45 people of different ages. And it showed that it is not only safe, it's not causing any disastrous side effects, but it's also efficacious. It's creating antibodies in the people who have taken it. So that means that Moderna is hoping to quickly move into a phase three trial. And that means that it'll be a much bigger trial on lots of people and hoping to find out that it works once we have a bigger population taking it.
Are they skipping phase two, going right to phase three?
So oftentimes phase one and two get kind of squished together. And so what we're seeing here is a speeded up version of a typical set of trials. So phase one and two are designed to determine, as I said, safety and efficaciousness. And so now in phase three, we try to see how it fares in a big population. They're hoping to have that phase three trial done in October, but that seems like a very early deadline. So it may take a bit longer than that.
And this is just one of many vaccine clinical trials out there, right?
That's right. There's a lot of other vaccines. There's about 150 vaccines in trial right now. And there's a couple of others that are already ready for phase three trials. There's the Oxford vaccine, which has also gotten a lot of attention, which also has demonstrated efficaciousness. It can create antibodies and an immune response in people who've taken it. So we're keeping a close eye on that vaccine as well.
Just because it creates the antibodies, do we know if it's going to have a lasting effect?
That is the big question that researchers are trying to figure out right now, because what we've seen is that people who've been infected with COVID-19 don't always develop antibodies. And so that's raising a lot of questions about whether these kinds of vaccines will last for a long time, or will they be more like a flu vaccine, which lasts for a few months and then you get it renewed every year?
All right, let's move on to your next story, the Trump administration sidestepping the Center for Disease Control and Prevention when it comes to COVID-19 hospital data. Just explain that. What's going on there?
What is going on there? So it's a little bit unclear. The Trump administration announced this week that they would be asking hospitals who normally report all of their data on infectious disease to the CDC to instead report it directly to the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the CDC. Right now, we're not sure who they're going to be reporting it to, what system they're going to use. Is this going to be part of the president's coronavirus task force or something else? The presidential administration is saying that the CDC is just moving too slowly, and so they need to do this other end run around their data gathering techniques. The CDC, of course, is saying that this is going to be a total nightmare because they already have a whole network of hospitals who know how to report to the CDC and have a system. Suddenly now all of that will be thrown into disarray, and it's unclear whether the data that we get will be recent or robust. And so we're just trying to...
Or accurate.
Or accurate. And, you know, this is coming in the wake of the president tangling with the CDC last week over reopening schools. The CDC recommended that schools not reopen. The presidential administration wants them to reopen. There's been this tug of war in news headlines. And so some people who are watching this unfold believe that this is just part of the presidential administration trying to put pressure on the CDC to do what the Trump administration wants.
Let's move on to another study that looked at the risk of COVID-19 and vaping and smoking. Wow, this one did not sound very good.
No, this is a really interesting study that came out of the University of California at San Francisco, my home institution. And they did a study on a very understudied group during this pandemic, which is young people ages 18 to 25. And they got a large sample. And what they found was that young people who smoke or vape have a 1 in 3 chance of developing a very severe case of COVID-19, one that may require a ventilator or simply cause a very long-term sickness. And this is in comparison to people in the same age group who do not smoke or vape, and they have a 1 in 6 chance of developing a severe case. So we're talking, you know, this doubles your chances, basically. And the way that they measured this was by asking participants whether they had smoked or vaped in the last month. So this is not just people who are heavy, heavy smokers. It's people who smoked within the last month have a much higher risk of developing a severe case.
That is very troubling.
That's right. So don't vape, kids.
Oh, goodness. Let's talk about your next story, one of something that's a little more, a little change of pace, let's call it. And this is one of our favorite topics, fossilized poop.
That's right.
So you take it from here because you'll do a better job at it than I will be asking about it.
So this is a study that I love because, first of all, it allows us to learn the scientific term for fossilized poop, which is coprolite, or plural, coprolites. And it also is a story about how careful researchers are before making really big new claims. So the poop in question is some human poop that was found in the Paisley Caves in Oregon's high desert, so in central Oregon. And the poop is from human beings, and it's 12,000 years old. And it was buried in a cesspit in the back of a cave where presumably humans were camping out. And several years ago, scientists sequenced the DNA in the poop to make sure that it was human. Because, you know, when you poop, some of your cells come off in your poop. So it can show up 12,000 years later. But the thing is that this poop is extremely old. It could have been contaminated by other materials at the site. So this new study looked at lipids in these turds to see how much they may have absorbed from the site around them. So just to make sure that these fragments of human DNA that they found really came from the poop and not from something else, or maybe even from the researchers. And what they discovered is, indeed, there had not been a lot of transfer of lipids between the site and the poop. So the poop had integrity. The DNA really is from people. And the exciting part about this is that it adds to a really complicated story about how immigrants populated the Americas. Many years ago, it was believed that humans from a group called the Clovis people came over the Bering Land Bridge and populated the Americas that way. But 12,000 years ago, that passageway would have been ice locked. You couldn't have made it. So these people who came and pooped in that cave had to have come over the ocean, along the Pacific coast, and then traveled to the interior of the continent along waterways. And Oregon's high desert did, in fact, used to be a very lush green area full of lakes and rivers. So that's probably how these folks got there and made their makeshift toilet in the back of that cave. So it's a great story about poop and science and how we all got here and who the ancestors are of today's Indigenous Americans.
You know, we have done stories about coprolite and scientists studying and looking for poop. And it's always fascinating that how they would know where to look, first of all, and how you identify it is, hey, you know, it's not just some mud sitting on the floor or an old piece of who knows what. The training it must take to say I'm a
coprolite.
Yeah, I'm a coprolite specialist. This is what I do, you know.
It's very valuable, especially in archaeology. And in this case, the people who used the Paisley Caves made it easy by digging a toilet in the back of the cave and just leaving it all in there real nice for us to find.
Oh, the mind could wander. Oh, let's move on to another really interesting story. And that is scientists found remnants of medieval glassmaking in Nigeria from 1,000 years ago. Now, I know glassmaking is older than 1,000 years, right? So there must be some time element that's important here.
So this is actually about 900 years old. And what's really interesting about this discovery is that until now, scientists believed that the glass that they'd found in sub-Saharan Africa all came from elsewhere. And what that suggested was that the people living in this region were able to trade for glass, but didn't have the technology yet to make it on their own. But the discovery of this workshop confirms what many people working on the ground had hypothesized for a long time, which is that a lot of these beautiful beads that we see in the region, and they really are incredible. They're these deep blues, and some of them are striped. Some of them are this incredible shiny red. These were all made locally in Nigeria with local materials that can be chemically identified. In this case, they were made with local snail shells and sand that came from that region. And in the workshop, they found, you know, half-made glass beads. So this really changes our understanding of the development of the civilization in sub-Saharan Africa and shows that they weren't just bringing in these high-status goods, these beautiful beads. They were producing them and trading them in a lot of different places. So it's a story about technology, but also about how these trade networks formed.
Always interesting stuff, Annalie.
Yep, I love beads and poop.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Annalie Newitz is a science writer and author based out of San Francisco. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what back to school, what the pandemic might mean for making plans, what this fall might look like. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're approaching August, which means for a lot of you, it's time to think about going back to school. Now, of course, in a normal year, that might mean getting new notebooks and pencils and the excitement of seeing your classmates after a summer apart. But COVID-19 means K through 12 this year is going to be different, sort of a big experiment with different systems around the country. Big school districts, including Los Angeles and San Diego public schools, are going completely remote for the fall. Other districts are looking at hybrid programs, with some time in the classroom and some time at home. And some districts may return to the classroom full-time. A lot of people have strong opinions about what the right strategy is for school in the fall. And here's what we heard from some of you on our Science Friday Vox Pop app.
I teach 11th and 12th grade students at a career tech center where most of our work is hands-on, so online education is tough. What I worry about most is students who are not willing to comply with social distancing guidelines, especially here in Michigan.
In terms of returning my high school students to school, I need the assurance that there's going to be testing at the high school so that they can tell immediately when there is an outbreak occurring.
I'm a teacher, and our school is planning to go back entirely as normal, which I strongly disagree with. I think during this pandemic, the only safe way to return to school is to do it online.
Those were listeners Jennifer from Michigan, Juanita from Maryland, and Diane from Utah. So, what needs to be considered for back-to-school plans? Joining us today to talk about this are Dr. Pedro Noguera, Dean of the Rossier School of Education, University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and Laura Fuchs, a high school history teacher in Washington, D.C. public schools and secretary of the Washington Teachers Union. Welcome, both of you, to Science Friday.
Great to be with you.
Thank you.
Laura, let me ask you first, how are you feeling about the possibility of returning in person in the fall?
Extremely apprehensive. We don't feel safe returning.
Are you hearing anything about a possible D.C. public school plan?
Yep. So it sounds like returning in a hybrid fashion where teachers would be present for 4 days a week, teaching two different rotating groups of students who'd be on for 2 days and then doing distance learning for 3 days. I suppose, while also engaging in distance learning with the students that aren't present.
Well, tell me about your concern. What will you need to feel safe?
To feel safe, especially in DC public schools, we need to build trust. And the only way to build trust is for teachers through the Washington Teachers Union to be at the table with DC public schools, creating the plans for how to carry out something as complicated as hybrid instruction. And until that happens, we don't feel safe returning.
Pedro, let's talk about that a bit. What approach would you like to see for K-12 in the fall?
Well, I think it would really help if the federal government, U.S. Department of Education, put out clear guidelines rooted in science, what we know about the virus and the risk, for how schools can reopen and when they should not. You know, we know now that Israel, that they reopened too soon. It became a site for which the virus spread. So there's clear evidence you can do this wrong. And I think the teachers' concerns are valid. But neither the federal government nor most states issued any of these guidelines, despite the political pressure to reopen.
Pedro, what are the CDC guidelines for reopening?
The CDC has offered guidelines. They are not that clear. If you're in a rural community where the infection rate is below 5%, it's probably safe to reopen schools. But there are lots of rural communities where that's not the case, here in California, where there are many agricultural workers who've been infected. So you need to have a more nuanced set of guidelines that speak to the conditions in your community and how to do this. In Los Angeles, where schools are already overcrowded, there's no way you could open schools safely without risking infection to kids and to the adults.
Mm-hmm. Laura, do you need physical partitioning and materials that you don't have?
I'm not going to claim to be an expert on what we would need in a classroom in order to be safe. What I do know is that these are all details that need to be discussed before students enter a building. And then we need to make sure that we have what we need in the buildings in advance of students arriving. So if it is decided that partitions are necessary, then we need to agree to those partitions and then have them in place before students come in.
Pedro, let me follow up about the hybrid approach that Laura was talking about that she expects some sort of form of. Should certain students be prioritized to come into school if there is a hybrid approach?
Yes, because we know that during this pandemic and during this long period of quarantine, there are many kids who have been really adversely affected, particularly kids with learning disabilities who require much more support, very difficult to provide that support online. But I would say there are a lot of young children who are learning to read who would benefit from being brought back into their classrooms so that they can get that support. Same is true for kids who are learning English for the first time and for children who are homeless or in foster care, whose living situation makes it difficult for them to learn at home. So I know these are tough choices, but there are clearly some kids whose needs are greater than others.
Earlier this week, we talked to Stephen Pruitt, who is president of the Southern Regional Education Board, which makes recommendations for school policies in 16 states. And this is what he said.
Remote learning for a lot of our students is going to be very difficult. And this is an issue both in urban and rural settings. In rural, you may have the issue of actually not having broadband access. But in our urban areas, especially in our students in poverty, there may be one computer that three children have to share.
Pedro, you do a lot of research about the digital divide, this idea that not all children have equitable access to the internet or computers. Is that a risk for not going back to the classroom?
Well, it's certainly a huge problem with respect to access to learning. And we've known this for a long time. There are a lot of kids in urban and rural areas who don't have internet access. It is not universal by any means, which is ironic given that we're a tech giant in the world. So, if we go completely online, we need to figure out what we will do. There are districts, New York and Los Angeles, that have really gone out of the way to get hotspots to kids so that they can get online and make sure there are screens so that they're not working on their parents' phones. But I would say we have a long way to go. There are millions of kids across the country, literally, who have not had any formal education since the quarantine period began.
Laura, you had to do some remote instructions in the spring for a little bit. How did that go?
Yep. So it was a difficult transition. So a lot of my students were accessing materials using their cell phone. We had not used a learning management system in my class because we were mostly a pen and paper class. So trying to set up those systems when all the students had very suddenly stopped attending in-person class was challenging. It was very time-consuming and very difficult for all the teachers that I know. And we weren't satisfied with the results. I don't know very many people who are satisfied with the results. That being said, we've been pushing to get more training on the new learning management system, more supports for our families, so that teachers don't have to serve as the primary tech support when we don't necessarily know how, and that our students can have better access to a higher quality distance learning instruction. Because the fact is that our schools are not yet safe to be reopened in August in the District of Columbia. And it's not fair to put on the students who already probably have a lot of the greatest risk factors and have seen a lot of the greatest impacts of COVID-19 to then have them have to come back into a school because as a city, we failed them in terms of their housing, in terms of their internet access, in terms of the financial supports that the district can afford. And so it shouldn't fall on the schools and the teachers to put themselves at risk to solve structural inequities that we've been fighting to change in this city for a long time.
This week, we also talked to middle school science teacher Megan Sorensen. She's from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and it's a remote area. But there has been a spike in COVID cases because of tourism to the county. People come there for the summertime. Her school is tentatively planning to go back to in-person instructions 5 days a week.
I'm very concerned about being around close to 100 students every day. It is really small community. Everybody is related to everybody else. So, you know, one person in a family is infected and you have aunties and uncles and cousins and everybody's just all together.
Pedro, do rural schools face these different challenges for figuring out how to teach in the fall than urban schools? What are those conversations like?
You know, again, the rural schools also face challenges with internet. Anybody who's ever driven around into the rural areas knows you sometimes lose cell phone service. So that's been a problem we've dealt with for a long time in this country. And so online learning in many rural areas is a huge challenge and not really feasible. At the same time, in many rural areas, though not all, it's safer to bring kids back in because there's lower risk of contamination. However, there are counties like Imperial County in California where the infection rate from testing is over 25%. And this is because many of the residents are agricultural workers who are being infected and bringing it home to their families. So you know, can't generalize about the rural areas. Each one faces its own distinct set of challenges and risks.
We got a message from listener John from Pleasant Hill, California on our Vox Pop app.
I'm a teacher, so is my wife. I'd say what we need is something like we had with SARS. I worked in China then, and they used cameras to rapidly test huge groups of people. It wasn't perfect, but at least it was a gross indicator of whether somebody might be sick or not. Otherwise, I don't see how we're supposed to manage school with all the little kids.
John is talking about thermal imaging cameras that can see heightened temperatures to see if you have a fever. And in New York, there are conversations about holding classes outside. So I'm thinking, what kind of other novel or creative solutions are you hearing about for getting back into the classroom?
I haven't heard that many. California, we're lucky we have good weather most of the year. So outside teaching could work in some places. Not Los Angeles. We simply have too many kids in the schools and we don't have enough physical space. So it really depends a lot on the community. In places where you have a lot of land and where they won't get kids too much exposure to the sun, I think outside teaching could be feasible. But that's not going to work in many other places.
Laura, do you have a reaction to that?
To me, really, any discussion of a quote-unquote innovative idea has to be vetted through teachers who would actually have to implement it. Like Pedro said, outdoor learning could be a potential option, but it might depend on the course. It might depend on the number of students. There'd still be a ton of contingencies that would need to be thought through and planned and prepared for. And then teachers would need to be trained on it and how to do it in a responsible manner. So it's not to say that there aren't potentially some really great solutions out there. I'm sure there are. But anything that's being driven by a district at the top and not being driven from the teachers themselves is not going to be effective.
Just a quick note that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. You're basically saying you want the teachers to have a voice, as we say, you want the teachers to be in the room where it happens, meaning the negotiations going on.
Yes, I think teachers need to be a part of it. We're the ones who will be doing the implementing. We're the ones who know our students. We know our parents. We know our classrooms. We know the physical space. We know what supplies we've had in the past, possibly, you know, not having soap in our bathrooms for year after year. And we know what it's going to take to be safe. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be with the district, helping think through all the potential problems and contingencies and plans for when things do go wrong, because we're teachers, we know how to problem solve on the fly. But we need to think through all those details before we can talk about bringing students into classrooms, because we have to keep them safe if that's what we're going to do.
So you're very concerned that the teachers are not going to have the resources necessary to safely bring the kids and teachers back into the classroom.
In the District of Columbia, we have no reason to trust that when we've had to buy our own paper and that there have been bathrooms without paper towels or working soap dispensers for years.
Are teachers going to have to be nurses now, you know, to be able to judge whether a kid is sick or not?
That's not an acceptable position for us. We do believe that there should be a licensed nurse at every school site that is open for staff and students.
Do you think, finally, we could see teacher strikes across the country this fall?
I think a lot of what we're talking about is that we've been doing distance learning since the spring. We wish that the district, and I think other districts as well, wish that their leadership had worked with them from the spring till now to be working on these plans together. But too many districts have chosen business as usual, where teachers are brushed to the side and ignored. And so now we're having to make our voices heard. We want to solve these problems. We want to get our students back in our classrooms. We miss them. We love them. Distance learning is not fun, but we can only do it if we're doing it safely. Anything else is irresponsible to our students and our families and those we love.
Pedro, what about on your side of the country out west in California? Are teachers this upset? And do you think that they might go on strike also?
The teachers are very upset at both at the district level and the state level. They've made it clear that they will not support a reopening of schools unless they have assurances that it can be done safely. And this, I think, speaks to why it's so shameful that we've allowed this issue to become politicized. And I blame the administration, the Trump administration, for kind of doing this, because we should be using the science to guide our actions. There are countries like Denmark and Germany that have shown you can do this well, you can do it safely, and you can do it without spreading the virus further. But we're not learning from those countries. And we I think, have minimized the risk. We had a district here in California, Orange County, which recently voted to reopen schools and not require a mask. And that's strictly a political decision. It has nothing to do with the risk associated with bringing kids back. So this, I think, is a real lesson in the failure of leadership to provide the kind of guidance that's needed at this critical moment in our country's history.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Please let me thank my guests, Dr. Pedro Noguera, Dean of the Rossier School of Education, University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and Laura Fuchs, a high school history teacher in Washington, D.C. public schools and secretary of the Washington Teachers Union.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a trip to Mars. Sounds kind of nice right now, doesn't it? We'll check in with NASA's Perseverance rover, soon to be launched. That's coming up after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Are you tired of staying home? Well, pack your bags. We're going to Mars. That's right. The flights are booked. The landing spot is ready. And NASA's next visitor to the Red Planet is nestled snugly aboard its Atlas V rocket. And if all goes well at the launch later this summer, Perseverance, the rover formerly known as Mars 2020, will touch down on Mars in February of 2021. And then, well, it's going to begin a quest to find signatures of microscopic long-dead life, if it is there to be found. Here to join me to talk more about the mission are my guests, Katie Stack Morgan, Deputy Project Scientist for Mars 2020 at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and Deanna Trujillo, a JPL aerospace engineer and the domain lead for robotic arm science. That's the one that carries many of Perseverance's scientific instruments. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Glad to be here.
Thanks, Ira. I'm super excited.
Oh, well, we're excited to have you. Thank you. Katie, we're sending another robot to Mars. What's different about this mission? What are we looking for?
Yeah, so this mission, it's the first mission in a potential Mars sample return campaign. And that's really what distinguishes Perseverance from previous rovers. Our objective is to collect and cache samples on the surface of Mars for potential return to Earth. And no other Mars mission has done that before.
Now, I know that Curiosity is up there already looking for water, still chugging along. Why can't that rover help with doing the same stuff?
That's right. The main goal for Curiosity has been to search for habitable environments, and it has done that, and it has done that successfully. And Curiosity has helped in the sense of expanding our understanding of habitable environments on Mars and what Mars was like in the ancient past. And so this mission seeks to build on that and taking it one step further, knowing that we're collecting samples with Perseverance to bring back to Earth. We're really looking for those samples that will give us the best understanding and chance of finding ancient life on Mars.
You mean you were looking for something that shows that Mars life may have happened in that spot?
That's exactly right. We look for what's called biosignatures, which are textures, patterns, or substances that we see in the rock that could have only formed by life.
Can you be fooled by that? I remember years ago, they were looking at samples they thought were made by microbes. Remember that whole fiasco? Yeah.
Well, yes. And you know, that's a really good point, because while we have a sophisticated suite of instruments on Perseverance that I think better enable us to search for biosignatures than any previous rover before, it's very likely that we'll have to get those samples back to Earth to say conclusively whether there was ancient life on Mars.
That's cool. I can't wait for that. Deanna, what is different about Perseverance as a rover, as an engineering advance?
I think that there's a lot of things that are different. The robotic arm itself has a much bigger turret. So think about the arm as a shoulder, elbow, wrist, just like yours. But when it gets to the turret where your hand will be, it's way bigger. It also carries instruments that we didn't have before, like Pixel, Sherlock, and Sherlock, which splits into Watson, which are pretty cool names, I will say myself. And then a drill, and then also a gas dust removal tool. Now, I'm very excited because if you look at the pictures of the drill, it also looks like a massive drill that is going to help us really get under that surface and give her the answers of what she's looking for, hopefully, and the science team as well.
Now, talk to me as an engineer now. What was the biggest engineering challenge you had to overcome?
The biggest challenge for my team really is the fact that the arm is holding together all of those pieces that I just mentioned, where any of those instruments that need to be pulled out for rework or reinstalled for rework or do functional testing or any capability or software update on any of those things, the robotic arm has to be involved. And it is kind of, you're building your Lego set, and every time you think that you got it working perfectly, somebody comes in and just takes a critical part of your Lego set. And then you have to rethink about everything again to make sure it works perfectly. And you're doing all of this in the floor, in the clean room, with a bunch of people waiting for you to nail it every time so you don't take their time for their functional.
Deanna just mentioned a lot of instruments. Watson, Sherlock, what are these instruments doing actually to find traces of life?
So the Pixel instrument, I'll start there. Pixel uses X-ray spectroscopy to search for chemical elements and to make maps of those chemical elements. And that's a really important advance that our instruments have that previous instruments haven't had. We can actually match up in detail a map of the geochemistry or the composition of the rocks with the very fine textures that an instrument like Watson, which is the camera, provides. And it's by mapping those textures to the composition and the distribution of organic matter, which is what Sherlock can provide, as well as the minerals that Sherlock can detect as well, that really give us the best chance of making a case for a potential biosignature. In the past, rovers have analyzed the entire rock all at once. And when you do that, you lose the ability to match the chemical signatures with the very fine textures.
If you map and find something there, will your mission have anything to do with finding the spots for a return sample mission?
Well, so what we're going to do is we are going to identify those potential samples that we think have the best chance of giving us evidence of signs of ancient life, as well as telling us about the evolution of Mars as a planet. And so we're going to drill and collect those samples. And our samples look something like a pencil or maybe your pinky. And we're going to store those samples in tubes that have been engineered to be very clean and very protective to ensure the scientific integrity of those samples. And then we will either put those samples down on the surface of Mars for the follow-on mission to collect, or we'll keep them in the body of the rover, and we may play a role ourselves in handing them off to the next leg of the mission.
Last time we talked, you had a science team in Australia to study the stromatolites left by ancient bacteria. Useful? Learn something?
Yes, absolutely. You know, Earth provides a fantastic laboratory and range of experiences for us to explore Mars. Some things about Mars are very similar to Earth, and we can use our experience on Earth to help inform how we study and approach Mars. But some things are very different, and we have to be thinking about that because there are surprises that Mars throws at us. Part of our team went out to Australia, and we talked about that about a year ago. And we also did another field test in Nevada with our science team this past winter. And that was a really valuable experience for our team and just, you know, prepares us really well for what it's like to do ops on the surface.
And what about the rover itself? How do you test out whether it can traverse the terrain, things like that?
So at JPL, we have a representation of how Mars looks with the terrain. We try to mimic that with the rocks, with the sand, with the inclination planes that we put in there to see if the rover can go up and down. So we do a lot of testing there. We also are fortunate to have other labs in where we have, for example, the motors that we will be using for driving, and we exercise how much life those motors have and how much can we drive it for how long. But the now understanding of how we are going to do all this driving where Katie's team wants us to go, it's now an additional lab that we put together with, in some cases, spare parts from the rover that we didn't use. And we create this additional test bed. We call it the vehicle system test bed. The vehicle system test bed is almost a full replica of what is flying to Mars with flight spares or with engineering models. And then we take it for a drive. We take the cameras, we do the whole end-to-end and prove to ourselves that this is going to work.
Have the wheels been upgraded? I know we had problems with some of the wheels in the previous rovers and getting stuck in the sand. Are they upgraded models that maybe the tread is better or the traction?
So a few things there. So yes, the design of the wheels is different. We have also looked at the software. As you might remember from Curiosity, when we started to have punctures on the wheels, we also upgraded the software to find ways of how to drive it in a way that we wouldn't create so much torque that we were puncturing the wheels, and new ideas or strategies about how to drive. Now, with respect to where we're driving and getting stuck in sand, this is the beauty now where there's an intersection in between the engineering team and the science team, where the science team also comes in and helps us with the understanding of what type of terrain we're about to get into. Is the sand packed? Is the sand loose? And if that is the case, how should we drive it?
What's it like trying to balance the science and the engineering concerns in this kind of project, Katie? I mean, you hand it off to Deanna and say, it's all yours, take it away, you know, but watch out for this. Or
that's a great question, and one that I think both Deanna and I will have a unique answer to. Of course, as scientists, we want to go to the best rocks that we see, but sometimes it's hard to get there, or the slopes are too steep, or it'll take too much time on a given day. And so there are all these trade-offs and kind of compromises that you have to make. At the end of the day, we want to try our best not to compromise the science of the mission. But sometimes we have to work with the engineers to figure out how to make that happen. And maybe it'll take a little bit longer than we had originally hoped it would, or maybe we have to take a different route. But in the end, the engineers are really our partners in helping to accomplish the science mission.
And if I could add to the answer that Katie just gave, I will tell you that that's the fun part of my job, where you actually start thinking about, hey, my job as an engineer is actually to enable this and not so much drive this. And so coming up with creative solutions to get what the scientists want is the part that makes operations so much more fun, right? Because you need to go back to, how did we design this thing? How did we engineer it? What's the maximum capability that I can squeeze out of the rover? And how creative can I get to get what she's asking?
I love it. Let's talk about the exact spot, Katie. Where's the exact spot the rover is slated to land and why?
Yeah, so the Perseverance rover is headed to a location on Mars called Jezero Crater, and it's a crater that's located on the inner rim of one of the largest and oldest impact basins. You know, life on Earth evolved around 3.5 billion years ago, and the rocks that we're going to with Perseverance are also about 3.5 to 4 billion years old. So when we think about Mars being different, you know, in the past than it is today, you know, we're going to the interval of time when Earth was developed, life was developing on Earth. And we think by probing that period of time on Mars, we have a chance to capture that potential evolution of life on Mars as well. And so we have an environment in Jezero that we think was really conducive to the occurrence and preservation of life. We have a delta, and we know that there was an ancient lake there. And we have some very interesting minerals that are really good at preserving signs of ancient life. And we know that from the Earth rock record. And we're optimistic that we'll see similar things on Mars.
I mean, you as a geologist, what's it like when you're looking at this and you just, oh, I wish I could take my hammer out and hit it or pick it up or something like that? Do you get that feeling sometimes?
You know, that's a funny question. And you're talking to two JPLers, and we do robotic space exploration. But it's true, you know, as a geologist, you know, sometimes you look at a rover image, and even if it's giving you a 360 degree view, or we're using the most close up camera that we have, it just isn't a substitute for actually picking up and holding that rock yourself. And that's one of the reasons why the Mars community and the scientific community has been so supportive of Mars sample return. Because before we're ready to send astronauts to Mars, we have the robotic capabilities to bring those samples to us. So we'll be able to hold those rocks. So even though we can't be there in person when we get those samples back, we'll be able to have all of the field notes that our science team has recorded and the data that the Perseverance collected to help us put the samples in context. It's similar to what geologists do. It's just broken up into pieces.
Just a quick reminder, I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. We're talking about NASA's Perseverance rover, soon to be launched to Mars. You know, one of the main banes to any mechanical object, wherever it is on Earth, on Mars, is dust. And I remember dust can get in the works of the gears. There were concerns that even on Mars, dust would cover the solar panels and keep some of the rovers from getting recharged. Deanna, are we still as worried about dust as we were before?
I think that we're always worried about dust, but I think that the question really is, from the designing standpoint, yes, there's concerns that the COGI needs to be taken into consideration. But when we now transition to actually operations, the operations is actually more manageable in a way because of the experiences, as you mentioned, from previous rovers. And the thing that I feel like it makes it very concrete for us is that we start thinking about it in a way as if there was a human on the surface of Mars and you're walking towards, you know, a dust devil, you're going to bring your head down, you're going to cover your eyes, you're probably going to turn around. And we do those sort of things with the rover. The science team knows that there is a dust storm coming our direction, and then we command all the cameras to look down, or we turn the rover, or we do things to make sure that, you know, the dust is not hitting us on the cameras. It is unfortunate when it hits us on the cameras, but at the same time, we try our best to, you know, use gravity to help us and also cover ourselves by canting the cameras down.
I imagine now your greatest anxiety is you must be getting the butterflies about the launch, right? We've worked so hard on this. Let's just get this launch off the ground, right, Deanna? You must be just saying, okay.
We're absolutely excited. I mean, we did every single test we can possibly think of. It's just incredible to know that now at this point, we're just thinking about what did we not do? What else can we fit in? You know, we engineers are constantly trying to maximize everything that we can possibly think of. So I feel like at some point, it's just launch, because we will find other ways of continuing to testing and things that we didn't do that we could have done. But in reality, we don't need it because we're so ready for this.
Katie, you too, a little bit anxiety?
Absolutely. Of course, there's always anxiety, though. This is the one part of the mission where it truly does feel like we have to turn the keys over. And there's really nothing as scientists that we can do at this point. We sit back and we watch it happen. And once we land on the surface, then we come in and we take over, and then it's our responsibility. So, you know, it's hard. We're on the edge of our seats, but it's also, you recognize that, you know, at this point we put up our hands and we cross our fingers and say, you know, let's hope that we've, you know, tested it and we know everything that's going to happen and it's going to turn out well. So, of course, always anxious, but optimistic and hopeful that we've done our job.
Well, we've been covering 30 years of rover launches on Science Friday, so we want to wish you the best of luck in this one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Great conversation. Dr. Katie Stack Morgan, Deputy Project Scientist for Mars 2020 at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and Diana Trujillo, a JPL aerospace engineer and the domain lead for robotic arm science. That's the arm that carries many of Perseverance's scientific instruments. One last thing to do before we go. It's July, and kids around the country, well, you know, they are running out of things to do. At Science Friday, we get it. So we're inviting those kids and adults to join us for a week of epic building and making challenges later this month. Try your hand at roller coaster construction, game design, and more. It is totally free, and there's loads of ways to participate, from a daily activity text to a virtual camp. Here's how to join us. Visit sciencefriday.com/buildtogether for more info and to sign up. That's sciencefriday.com/buildtogether. Charles Berquist is our director. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Feather, Kathleen Davis. Our intern is Adebay Rodriguez Benitez. BJ Liederman composed our theme music. And if you missed any part of this program, or you'd like to hear it again or tell your friends about it, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker now to play Science Friday. Oh, our Science Friday Vox Pop question this week. Have you had to navigate pregnancy or the first few months of raising a baby during this pandemic? Tell us about your experience. That's on the Science Friday Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our sense of smell is a bit of mystery, is it not? Even for scientists. We know what a color will look like based on its wavelength. Every color has a predictable signature. But predicting the smell of something? Whoa, that's a bit more difficult. For example, think of a sea breeze smelling candle. Does it really smell like the sea? I mean, how can the ocean be in a candle? But once you sniff that candle, you are transported to the coastline and that wafting breeze, yes. How does our brain keep track and organize the millions of scents that we sniff? That's what a group of scientists wanted to find out. They gave mice molecules to smell and tracked what patterns were formed in the brain. Their results were published in the journal Nature, and here to talk about it is one of the authors on that study, Robert Datta. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Neurobiology at Harvard Med School, joining us to talk more about how we sniff out smells. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
So tell us, why has the sense of smell been so elusive to scientists?
There's a couple of reasons. One is that smells are really, really complicated. If you think about the odors that are coming off your morning coffee, that scent is actually made up of more than 800 separate individual molecules. And somehow your nose recognizes all of those different molecules, and your brain synthesizes that into the delicious smell of coffee in the morning. And so because of the complexity of odors themselves, for a long time there have been challenges in our understanding how the brain might organize information about different odors and make sense of them.
That is really cool. You were studying mice and you gave them some odor molecules. Give me an idea of what you were looking for in the brain afterwards.
So we do experiments where we use microscopes to look at neural activity in a part of the brain that's responsible for processing information about smells. And it's a part of the brain called the piriform cortex. We as humans have a piriform cortex just like the mice. And we were looking to see what different patterns of activity emerge as we gave these mice different kinds of smells.
And is there a definite pattern of activity? And is it located in a certain part of the brain?
Yes, there definitely is. You know, our goal in this study was to answer two main questions. So first, we wanted to understand, you know, why is it that you and I, Ira, both think that lemon and lime are similar to each other? We both agree that lemon is different from pizza. And the second thing we wanted to understand was, you know, why is it that smell seems to be so personal? Why do I think that the way that I interact with the odor world might be a little bit different from the way that you interact with the odor world? And so the thing we wanted to look for first was whether the patterns of activity we saw in this smell center in the brain called the piriform cortex were similar in me and you. And what we discovered was that the relationships in the patterns that are evoked by similar odors themselves tended to be similar. So lemon and lime activate similar patterns of activity in my brain, and they activate similar patterns of activity in your brain. And that's why you and I both agree that lemon and lime are two similar odors. But if we expose a mouse to different odors, we can actually change the relationships between patterns of activity that we observe in the brain, and we can change the way that animals perceive those odors. And so although you and I both agree that lemon and lime are similar, based on our odor experience, the way that we've interacted with odors in the world, our brain is clearly flexible and plastic and capable of changing the way that it represents information about odor relationships to support our perception of different odors.
You know, this is all interesting because we all have a time where it could be 10, 20, 30, who knows how many years later, where suddenly you smell something you haven't smelled for decades, and then this memory just comes right out. What's going on there?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about smell is that it was the first sense really to evolve. It's the most ancient sense we have as mammals. And so the neural circuits that are responsible for processing smell are organized in a very different way from those of the other senses. So if you were to ask me, you know, how many neural connections does it take to get from your retina when you see something to a part of your brain that's involved in memory, like the hippocampus, that number is really large. It's like 10 or 20 interconnections between, you know, your eyeball and a part of your brain that's responsible for memory or, say, emotion. In olfaction, that number is 2. So information about smells goes to your nose. There's one kind of processing station in your brain called the olfactory bulb. And then immediately it goes to parts of your brain involved in memory, like the hippocampus, or involved in emotion, like the amygdala. And so there's this very intimate brain connection between smells in the world and your emotional responses to those smells and your memories that are also associated with those smells and when you experience those smells. And part of the reason why my lab is so fascinated with smell is because of this really intimate connection between these emotional and memory centers in your brain and the world of smells around us.
How do you train somebody to know what something should smell like or shouldn't?
So there's really two parts to this process. One is gaining language for describing what you're smelling. You know, we as humans, depending on our culture, use very different language to describe different kinds of smells. And the parts of our brain that are responsible for generating language are actually very far separated from our noses, unlike our centers for emotion and memory. So although when you smell a scent from your mom's kitchen, you can evoke this deep memory, you'll often have trouble finding the words to describe what you're smelling. And so part of what training gives you is just language to accurately describe what you're perceiving. But it's also quite clear that as you gain more and more experience with odors, your olfactory circuits are quite plastic, and they will readily learn to better discriminate and categorize odors. It's actually part of what our paper's about, is thinking about how odor circuits discriminate and categorize odors. And it's clear that the olfactory system is really wonderful at addressing both of those questions and those problems, and is capable of learning based upon experience.
Well, then tell me, I'm bringing this back to where I started about light. If we know the certain frequency or wavelength of light, we can create the exact color we want. Can we do that with smells? Can you put a molecule together that gives you the exact smell that you want?
You're asking a fabulous question. And this is really a long-standing dream of people who are interested in the olfactory system. Wouldn't it be marvelous if we knew enough that we could construct an artificial molecule and before even smelling it, know what it was going to smell like? This is something that's not yet possible. We're just beginning to learn how chemical structures relate to patterns of neural activity in the brain, which is, of course, part of what our study was about. And understanding that relationship, understanding how chemistry evokes different patterns in your brain, is really the first step towards building some sort of machine that will allow you to predict what a specific odor chemical will smell like. And you can imagine that if you could build such a machine, that'd be amazing in terms of helping people make tastier foods or more attractive fragrances. And it will also allow you to virtualize smell. You could imagine that instead of just having a virtual reality being visual, you could have olfactory virtual reality where there were machines that were in front of you that would spit out chemicals that you would smell in real time that would evoke various known odor percepts.
Aromatherapy.
Exactly.
I'm imagining there must be some connection between our taste buds, what we taste and what we smell, because, you know, the old saw says that what you're really tasting, you're doing a lot of smelling.
Yep.
So is it wired into your brain that way, too?
Yeah, so flavor is thought to be the combination of smell and taste. And when you chew food up, the food gets kind of mushed up in your mouth. And then odors released from the food, and you detect those odors through something called retronasal olfaction. That is, the stuff that's coming off of your food goes up into the back of your nose, and you smell it. And your brain then synthesizes information from your taste buds and from your olfactory neurons in your nose in a part of your brain called the insula to create perceptions of flavor. So those two things are really intimately linked. And if you lose your sense of smell, as you know, all of a sudden the flavor in your food disappears. That's what happens when you get a cold.
Well, that brings me to the question about what's going on with COVID-19 and losing smell. How are these things related?
Right. So it turns out my laboratory has also recently published a paper along with an international consortium of researchers exploring how it is that COVID might affect your sense of smell. As I've just told you, you know, odors in your nose are detected by these olfactory receptor neurons express odor receptors, and these receptors interact with odors, and then these neurons alert your brain to what you're smelling at any given moment in time. And so I think we and many others started with a hypothesis that maybe the virus infects these olfactory sensory neurons and damages them or kills them in some way. And that's how come when you get COVID, you lose your sense of smell. But the emerging data from our lab and the labs of our many collaborators really suggests that instead what's probably going on is that the novel coronavirus is infecting support cells that live around these olfactory sensory neurons. And so somehow through infecting these support cells, your neurons in your nose stop functioning properly, and so you can't smell odors anymore. And we actually think this is pretty good news because it suggests that people with COVID who lose their sense of smell will eventually regain their sense of smell once these support cells kind of regenerate and heal.
That is good news. As someone whose job and sounds like passion is sleuthing and smelling everything, smelling all the roses along the way, do you drive people crazy stopping to smell stuff?
I do. Especially when I go to when I go shopping, I cannot stay away from the perfume counter. Some of my favorite moments. Some of my favorite moments are discovering new smells just out in the environment. It's fun to study a scent that I find really personally very satisfactory. You know, in science, this is called me-search. You do research on the thing that you yourself find most interesting. And for me, this has definitely been quite a bit of research.
Well, that's great that you enjoy it. And maybe someday one of these perfume companies will name something Data after you. You never know. Thank you, Robert. Robert Data is one of the authors of a study in Nature about smells. He's also assistant professor in the Department of Neurobiology at Harvard Med School. And I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, in science, if you want to understand variations in living things, you take a close look at them and you catalog the details of what you see. For example, in his field notebooks, Charles Darwin made sketches of everything from finch beaks to barnacle shells. Natural history museums catalog shelves and drawers of preserved specimens. And now there's even one team of researchers looking at works of art. They're looking how different plant species are represented in paintings and sculptures. Producer Alexa Lim has more.
When you visit a museum, you've probably run across a still life painting. Usually, the image is filled with commonplace objects, maybe a vase with a bouquet of flowers, or cups overturned with fruits cascading across the table. And when you step in for a closer look, you might think to yourself, is that a strange-looking apple? Or maybe it's an orange? Well, you're not alone. A plant biologist and an art historian have teamed up to catalog the fruits and vegetables in works of art. They're looking at details in these paintings and sculptures as a way to figure out the evolutionary history of some of these plants. Their results were published in the journal Trends in Plant Science. Yves de Smet is a plant biologist at VIB Ghent University's Center for Plant Systems Biology, and David Vergouwen is a lecturer in cultural history at Amaranth. They're both authors on that study and joining from Ghent, Belgium. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Yves, as a plant biologist, you use genetics to study plant development. You have a lot of technical scientific tools. So why look at art? What can that fill in that maybe molecular biology can't?
Well, in a way, because it's fun. This is kind of an out-of-hand hobby project between David and myself. And what we try to do with the kind of molecular component here is we are really trying to explain why certain differences are what they are. So what we observe on a painting, certain phenotype, certain features of color, shape, size, and these kind of things, can we find some molecular explanation for those components? And with all the knowledge we have nowadays on how plants grow, the kind of metabolic pathways that are involved in generating color and taste and these kind of things. So we know the key individual players for that. We can actually try to use that information to really find a good explanation.
And David, on your end, artists aren't always making exact representations of what they're seeing. So how do you weed out the information from what I'm going to call the artistic license?
Well, that is a fundamental problem when tackling this sort of research. Artists can be quite fanciful, and it is the job, or my job as an art historian, to make sure that the information that we collect from these paintings, these objects of art, that they are in some way representational for our study. So that means finding out or finding a method to really know what is reliable and what is not. For example, if you look at a painting from 16th or 17th century Dutch painters or Flemish painters, how can you really know that in a market scene, the fruit and vegetables that are depicted are really as they were at the time? Because some of these combinations seem quite odd because they don't grow in the same season and probably weren't put up for sale at the same time. So what we then do is we look at other things. So you can look at the clothes people are wearing, or you can look at the architecture. If there is architecture on a painting and you can visit that actual place and the architecture is still there and you can cross-reference the existing place with the painting. Or you can look at musical instruments if they're on the painting, and you can go to a museum and check out those musical instruments. And that is the way how we can double-check and cross-check the validity of the things that we are observing on a painting.
And this whole project was kicked off by a painting of a melon. Can you tell me how that happened?
That is a funny anecdote. We've been friends for like way back, and every once in a while we get the permission of our wives to go and visit a city that they don't want to visit. And we found ourselves in Russia, in St. Petersburg at the Hermitage, with a painting by Frans Snijders, a Flemish painter from the 17th century. We were discussing whether or not the melon that was depicted on that painting was in fact the way it used to look. So I asked Steve, is this the way a melon looked in the 17th century? And he said, well, maybe it's just a bad painter. And then I said, no, this is Frans Snijders. He's a really good painter. He's very reliable in that case. So then we kind of started to take out our mobile phones and look for references and scholars and articles that might, have some sort of indication of what was going on. And we quickly discovered that there were not that many people who were interested in cross-referencing art history with genetics. And that's how we started talking.
Basically, what was shown was a watermelon cut in half, and it was white on the inside, which is a bit unusual, no? Because if you think of a watermelon, everybody recognizes the outside as having this dark green stripy pattern, so alternating dark and pale green. And on the inside, if you cut it in half, it's really dark red. So the one that was depicted there was white.
Are you confident to say this is a watermelon?
There are a number of possibilities there. No? So there are other examples. So there is a nice example from an Italian painter, Stanchi, who also paints a strange-looking watermelon when cut in half. So it's a bit more white, pinkish, with this kind of weird swirls on the inside. And then, of course, you can discuss, is this now a watermelon that was not fully matured? Is this a watermelon that was grown in conditions where it was deprived of, for example, water or nutrients or something like that? Or is this really a mature watermelon as it existed? And there are a number of botanical elements that you can consider for that. So if you look at the ripening process of the watermelon, it indeed starts off as being white, and then it kind of goes through this stages of turning pink until it finally becomes really red. And when it's becoming red, the seeds, the mature seeds, are black in color. So you really know dark red together with black colored seeds is a mature watermelon. If you go and look at an immature stage, then you see that it's either white or pink, and then the seeds are whitish in color. So then it's not fully developed. The way both Stanchi and Snijders depicted is essentially a watermelon which is white or pale pinkish in color, but with black seeds, really indicating that it is probably a mature watermelon. Which doesn't mean that at the time the red fleshed watermelon did not exist. So probably both varieties coexisted at some point, because if we look into this genetic evidence of this watermelon from 3,500 years ago from old Egypt, we do see that at the time the red fleshed watermelon probably already existed. So the sweet tasting red fleshed watermelon occurred already 3,500 years ago.
You've also looked outside of Europe, and one example is the potato. What's the story behind that?
Well, the story about potato is extremely interesting because the potato was a crop originated from South America, of course, which sustained civilizations like the Moche, for whom this potato was very important. And it figures quite predominantly in their pottery, which has a lot of these small characters, kind of humanoid looking. And they are made out of potatoes because you can actually see the eyes of the potato that are molded into the sculpture. And you can find this kind of pottery not only with the Moche, but also all the way down to the Urpu-style Inca pottery. And it goes to show how important it was as a calorie source for these civilizations. And it is probably also related with the downfall of the Moche by the hand of their more powerful neighbors, the Tiwanaku, who, once they conquered the region about around Lake Titicaca, really controlled the potato trade at that time. But the interesting bit to note is that even though the potato was quite known in Europe in the 16th century, it wasn't really eaten in any significant amount, wasn't really adopted in any culinary practice before the middle of the 18th century. So there is kind of a time lag between the discovery of this potato and the actual adoption in the kitchen. And this is quite astonishing since, for example, the Inca, they had stability of food sources, not only with the potato, but also with maize, the corn coming in from Mexico. So they have two calorie sources that are quite efficient. Whilst in Europe, we only had the wheat. So we only had this one calorie source, which And the introduction of the potato really introduced some sort of food stability. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that this story about looking at paintings and finding out the genetics and telling the story of the evolution and the travels really involves the story of the rise and fall of civilization, of exploration, of cultural adoption, culinary practices, and so on. So it is really the story about how humankind molded its food into its own needs.
There are often a number of misconceptions. No? So typically the potato was feared in a way because it's a member of the nightshade family, the Solanaceae, and then members of this family are typically poisonous. So that's why people didn't really like to eat those types of fruits and vegetables. So they have the potato, the tomato, has a similar association. It's kind of this guilt by association that kind of caused that these fruits and vegetables were not really popular at the time.
So is there like a different representation of the potato in Europe then? Or do you know when it first, like the first image of a potato happened?
But the first really kind of depicted potato kind of associated with the time that it arrived in Europe, we haven't spotted that one yet. So I think we have a few examples. We have mentions in the literature. This is one of the things that we still would like to explore in a little bit more detail. So when do we start? So how often is the potato depicted? So we don't have a very good overview of that.
We do have it with a tomato, and that's also interesting because you were just explaining that they were guilt by association and a bit feared at the time for various reasons. The interesting bit is that when the tomato is introduced in southern Spain, it takes about 70 or 80 years before it appears on a painting by, I believe it is Murillo, who has this famous kitchen scene and actually depicts a tomato. And then you can look into the past to see what it was shaped like. And it was a red kind of cœur de bœuf style tomato. And these things are quite valuable because then you can have descriptions or you can have botanical drawings. But if you can see it with full shapes and colors, just lying around an early 17th century kitchen, that's really spectacular. So if we could find something like that with a potato on there, then we'd be very happy.
Wow, a potato mystery. Are there plants that seem to be painted and represented consistently?
As far as we've noticed, I think the onion is one example where we see very little variation. Also with respect to, I think, apples and things like that, cherries, grapes, you have a lot of diversity, but that's clearly captured. So you can really see this kind of enormous diversity of apples. But it always looked like an apple. So it's not kind of an unusual depiction that we spotted or something like that. Same with grapes. No, that's also something. And onions are the same. They're always recognizable as an onion as far as we've seen so far.
So are we talking about the bulb of an onion or the stalk?
It's the bulb of an onion. Okay, not the stalk. It's really the bulbous part of the onion. That.
You all are focusing on fruits and vegetables, but plants in general. I mean, how else could this be applied?
We're not going to do this for cattle. We're not going to do this for regular flowers and things like that. So really kind of try to define a niche, although it can be applied to all these other things as well. I mean, you can also look at butterflies and at lichens and basically draw conclusions with respect to pollution at the time, but really kind of try to define our niche around plant-based foods, essentially. But that's the nice thing. I mean, these painters are able to paint something which is kind of photographic quality. So you can really rely on a lot of these artists to draw conclusions based on what they depicted.
I'm Alexa Lim, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. David, did you ever think you'd be critically looking at apples and pears?
Not in my life. So I was kind of dragged into this because it might be surprising to know that I am not really that into biology. I've always wondered why Eve went off to study biology. But it brought us a bit more together as friends, I think. And working together has been tremendously big fun. So I have learned a lot and more than I have ever thought about genetics and plants and fruits. And you can't imagine.
There is some miscommunication. There are certain species names and things like that that David refuses to pronounce or to name correctly. And I'm terrible with years. I mean, I don't know when a certain painter lived and worked and these kind of things.
I guess on that note, you're asking for help from people. So what do you want them to do?
Well, we can be at all museums at the same time. We cannot visit. I mean, there's not enough time for us to look at physically every painting that might be interesting. So we are just asking the public to help us, to assist us in a very simple way. If you are in a museum and hopefully a museum that is not that well visited, maybe obscure collections, or it can be a big museum where there is just one detail that you're focusing on. Well, take a picture. Take a picture of the fruit or the vegetable that you find interesting, a weirdly shaped carrot or an odd-looking onion. We are interested. Take a picture of the detail. Take a picture of the painting. And please don't forget to take a picture of the little sign next to the painting indicating what it is that we are looking at.
It might be even more spectacular, right? If we find a potato from it on a 13th century European painting, that might completely change our view on trading routes and conquest and discoveries. No? So that these things could be really interesting. And the important bit is that when you have taken these pictures and collected all this information, you can just email it to us to artgeneticsdavideve@gmail.com, and then we try to do something with that. And we also have the artgenetics hashtag, yes.
Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Yves DeSmit is a plant biologist at VIB, Ghent University's Center for Plant Systems Biology. And David Vergouwen is an art historian at Amerint in Ghent, Belgium. And if you want to help with their catalog, you can tweet your photo out with the hashtag ArtGenetics. And you can see images of the works of art up on our website at sciencefriday.com. For Science Friday, I'm Alexa Lim.
After the break, the world is getting louder. Has your hearing suffered? We'll talk about hidden hearing loss, what's next in hearing assistance technology, and why prevention is still your best cure. It's all coming up after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine that you and I are sitting across the table from each other at a crowded restaurant, just a couple of old friends catching up. What? Can you say that? What did you say? Sorry, I really can't hear you. Does that happen to you, right? It's common. You have trouble making out words. You're not alone. You're in a restaurant. All that background noise gets in the way. If you're a member of the baby boomer generation like I am, that scene may feel pretty familiar, especially if you have a tinnitus in one ear or both ears. I have them in one ear. Unfortunately, there is no silver bullet for tinnitus or other forms of hearing loss that come with age, and researchers don't even understand all the ways in which the auditory system can go awry. But we now have more sophisticated technology to help us cope with it. These days, there are over-the-counter hearing aids and assistive listening devices that connect, for example, with your smartphone. Tech that lets you amplify softer sounds or cancel out the noise of a crowded room. Even zoom in on the sound waves created by the person you're speaking with. And in fact, so much has changed about the industry catering to people with hearing loss that my next guest wrote a whole book about it. David Owen is a New Yorker staff writer and author of the new book, Volume Control, Hearing in a Deafening World, which is out now. David, welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you. That restaurant clip gave me the chills.
Isn't that really familiar, right?
Yeah, I talked to, when I was working on this book, I'd talk to people, I'd ask friends, how's your hearing? Oh, it's pretty good. They go, except in restaurants. And it makes a big impression on people.
And isn't that one of the first symptoms of having a hearing loss is that you keep saying, what?
Yes.
I didn't hear it. Say that again, right?
Yes, and unfortunately, the average wait time between noticing that you have a hearing problem or suspecting that you have one and then actually doing something about it is 10 years. That's the average that people wait.
Is that because they think they can just plow through it or that they can't be having a hearing loss?
I think there are a number of reasons. I think one is that we don't take hearing anywhere near as seriously as we should. We don't realize how important it is in our lives. Another is just, you know, sort of good old human inertia. And another is a kind of the stigma, the perceived stigma of having hearing aids. It's a sign of decrepitude, hearing loss. There was Charlie Rose, back when he was on TV, did an hour-long show on hearing and hearing loss. And during that whole time, he never mentioned that he was wearing hearing aids. He had two hearing aids on. And one of his guests, who was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, you could see his hearing aids, and he also never brought it up. So there's some feeling that it's somehow shameful or embarrassing to do something to help your hearing.
Yeah, because and something that comes along with hearing loss is, as I mentioned in the intro, that I have a tinnitus ringing in my ear, one of my ears, my right ear, and that compounds the problem.
Yeah, I have it too, and it's I've discovered that one of the very worst things you can do for tinnitus is to write a book about it, because then you're thinking about it all the time. And the unfortunately, there's no known cure. Treating it mostly involves helping people learn to tolerate it, or to mask it with other sounds, or to sort of make it less apparent by prescribing hearing aids to bring up the sound of other things so that the tinnitus is less apparent. But it is the number one service-related health claim made by military veterans. It's soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan and then back through every war that we've fought since the Civil War. It's been a problem for soldiers.
Because if you have a rifle on your shoulder and you fire it, it's a loud boom.
That's right. Right-handed infantrymen tend to go deaf on the left side. That's the ear that's the closest to it. And then it happens in surprising places, too. Violinists lose hearing in exactly the same way in the left ear. We don't think of symphony orchestras as being harmful to hearing. We tend to think of, like, you know, heavy metal rock. But classical musicians are prone to it, too. And it's often not your instrument. It's the instrument of the person sitting behind you. So it's the French horn right at your head in the chair in back of you.
You know, and speaking personally, you don't really, you know, the old saying, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. Because I'm almost deaf in one ear, I try to make sure I protect my other ear from any kinds of loud sounds. And living in New York City, walking down the street, you know, I really find myself cupping my ear, closing it off, putting my finger in it when a truck or something goes by. And a lot of people are just not doing that kind of thing, and we're exposed to loud sounds all the time that may be harmful.
Oh, it's so true. You know, I was just watching a football game over the weekend, and the commentators were talking about how enthusiastic the fans are. The sound of the cheering, it's so loud, the linemen can't hear the quarterback calling signals. And they actually gave a decibel reading, and it was well above the level that can with sufficient enough exposure can cause permanent hearing loss. And it's, you know, it's not a good thing to be this enthusiastic with this many people. It's not good for your ears.
You know, but the good news about this now is that we have cell phones and electronic devices that might make up for some of the shortcomings we have with hearing loss. For example, I discovered, because I know so many people who have hearing aids, that hearing aids can now be hooked on to your cell phone. On your iPhone, for example, you can hook it right on there, and then you can sort of slide your cell phone across the table. Mm-hmm. And it acts sort of like a remote microphone going to your hearing aid.
That's right. You can they're very expensive devices that do the same thing, but you can do that. I got my mother's 90. She's had trouble with her hearing. She's been reluctant to go and get hearing aids. So I bought her. I think I spent $80. A device called Super Ear. It is a little unit that's maybe the size of smaller than a cigarette pack of cigarettes. It hooks to a wired pair of earphones, and she can adjust it and place it on the table. You know, all she has to do is be willing to have this visible sign that she's not hearing. But she did take it to dinner with some friends, and they passed it around. And I've done the same thing with more sophisticated devices. You know, go to a sports bar. I have a pair of headphones called Hearphones made by Bose, and they're basically, they have the same chip that hearing aids do, but they have a bigger battery, so they have better Bluetooth. They have bigger speakers, so the sound is better. They have noise canceling inside the ear canal, as well as outside. So you can, in a restaurant, if we had been in that situation at the beginning of this segment, I could have turned down the sound of the restaurant and focused on you specifically without putting my phone on the table. And, you know, we would have had an easier time talking.
That's great to hear. Are there any treatments? Because if you of a certain age, you hear on TV, you watch commercials that say, oh, there's this miracle cure for tinnitus, you know?
Right.
But there is no such thing, is there?
No. And you search for it once on Google and your email inbox fills up with all these claims of, you know, the food you should eat, you know, this thing that doctors don't want you to know. Don't let the American Medical Association know that you know about this. Unfortunately, they don't work. There's some things that people find that help them. One, surprisingly, something that sometimes helps me is to simply pretend that my tinnitus, this high-pitched sound, phantom sound in my head, is a masking sound that I'm playing to cover up my tinnitus. And that doesn't always work, but sometimes it does. I'll turn on a fan, turn on the air conditioner. I have some earpieces that actually play a masking sound, and they help too.
Yeah, some people will put their white noise machine on at night.
Right, exactly. Right. And you can get something that's sort of in that kind of covers it. I've walked in places where the traffic noise, that just kind of steady hum from an interstate highway, was right in the right frequency range to make me unable to hear my tinnitus. Or in the fall with cicadas and crickets, that's kind of in the same range. And then I hear only them. I don't hear this phantom noise in my brain that usually I only notice when I'm lying in bed or writing about it. Yeah.
The new research on tinnitus suggests that it's something like phantom limb pain, right? It's not there, but you still feel it.
I think this is beginning to be the accepted idea now. Your brain is used to receiving signals in certain frequency ranges. Now you've lost the ability to hear those ranges, and so it makes its best guess about what ought to be there. It fills something in. And so there are some treatments that work with some people that involve kind of training the brain to ignore that entire frequency range. Tinnitus is tricky because it's not a sound. It's not sound waves coming into your head. It's electrical activity taking place in your brain. So people at Bose are always asked, well, can't you make noise-canceling headphones that will take care of this? And they say, no, we need, in order to cancel sound, we need sound, and you don't have sound. This is something else. But, there's hope. There's always hope.
Yeah. You mentioned Bose, and I think about this a lot. Why doesn't Bose or Apple or somebody go into the hearing aid business that they know all about sounds? They make all these phones and they make the headphones. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of baby boomers and people who are youngsters who are going, getting deaf from all the loud music they're playing. This would seem like a great business model, you know?
No, it seemed that way to them, and people suggest it all the time. And Bose actually now has been approved for a hearing aid. There will be a hearing aid coming from Bose. And my Bose earphones, these headphones, they function. They can't legally call them hearing aids, but I can. I mean, they're hearing aids that I like better than hearing aids. One reason that these companies have not been involved fully yet is that it's really hard to make a hearing aid. And they all thought, well, we have the expertise, we'll get into it. But the processor inside a hearing aid, the circuitry inside a hearing aid, the antennas, it is tiny, and it had to be invented by the hearing aid industry because there is nothing off the shelf that works. And so Apple has a partnership with a hearing aid manufacturer, but it took them years to do what they thought they would be able to do immediately based on what they already knew. And they've all discovered that it's much harder than they thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. You know, I always think that there's going to be new research coming out by the Pentagon. The Pentagon spends so much money, has so many soldiers that are in combat and suffering all kinds of losses. And from reading in your book, it seems like they know about, as you say, one of the number one injuries in combat is loss of hearing or tinnitus, and they have a way of getting combating that.
You know, it's interesting. Military personnel we've known for centuries that warfare is bad for hearing, that gunfire deafens people, that artillery fire, that simply being around, you know, in military equipment, military vehicles deafens people. But it's really only in the past few years that the Pentagon has begun to use truly effective hearing protection devices. There are hundreds of pending lawsuits right at the moment over what were supposed to be protective earplugs that were issued to soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. But they were defective. They didn't work. The Pentagon knew they were defective. The manufacturer knew they were defective. And you think, you know, we knew during the Civil War, we knew before that, we knew in the age of sail that exposure to explosions deafens people. And yet the focus has always been more on compensation than on prevention. So, you know, the Veterans Administration is the largest single purchaser of hearing aids in the United States, but much more money has gone into that than has gone into research to protect the hearing of soldiers.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking with David Owen, New York staff writer and author of the new book, Volume Control: Hearing in a Deafening World. Great book, especially for, you know, if you think you may have don't want to admit that you have a hearing problem. And that the title is really indicative of the state we are. We are in a deafening world. There are so many loud things around there. We have a tweet from David who says, there are also some nice decibel meters available online to improve your awareness.
That's true. I have
one in my cell phone has a dB meter that I use.
Yeah, one of the difficulties with decibels is that even scientists who understand them have a hard time explaining them. The scale is logarithmic. It's not so 90 decibels is not is not just a little bit louder than 80 decibels. It's a lot louder. And I think I came up with a scale of my own, which is, you know, things like whisper, soft voice, chainsaw, rock concert, more items that we're more familiar with than we are with these numbers that we don't really, that are very hard to understand. The basic takeaway, though, is that we are exposed constantly, especially somebody, you know, living in a big city, but really everywhere, to really loud sounds that can hurt our hearing.
You know what the loudest sound for what I do for a living is listen. The loudest, most annoying sound I have found recently, and I actually brought my decibel meter to check it out, was in the airline bathroom. When you flush that airline toilet, it's over 100 dB.
Yeah, that's loud.
And it peaks out there.
You know,
people thought I was crazy. Yeah.
The federal regulations, there are sounds that are close to painful or certainly damaging that workers in covered industries are allowed to be exposed to for, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year. And you know, even the government knows that the what regulations we have are not sufficient to protect those people. It was also, as I was thinking, one of the threats to the health of marine mammals is human-generated sound. The largest single input of human-generated sound into the oceans is ocean shipping, the sound of the engines in ships. But we also, you know, we explore for gas and oil by basically setting off explosions underwater, then listening to the seismic echoes. All of these things have devastating effects on marine life. It's marine mammals, which have ears like ours, and we don't even know what impact we're having.
Yeah, we really are not aware of how loud the sounds we are and the sounds we are making that might disturb our the world we live in.
That's true. And I always used to make fun of my wife because she would put on earplugs when she used her food processor. But now I do it, too. You know, she bought me, when I was working on our house, she bought me a set of protective earmuffs. And I would only put them on if I thought that she could see me. But now, you know, now I wear them all the time. And I carry a pair of musician's earplugs on my keychain. And I'll put them in even, you know, my wife and I went to see the movie Dunkirk, which is basically one continuous explosion from the opening credits to the end. And it made it tolerable. It was painful otherwise.
Yeah, I get it, because I bring mine to weddings and bar mitzvahs where the bands are very loud.
Yes, thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah, David Owen, New York staff writer, author of the new book, a great book, Volume Control: Hearing in a Deafening World. And we have an excerpt on our website at sciencefriday.com/volume. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, David.
Oh, thanks, Ira.
And that's about it for this hour. If you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. And on Science Friday Vox Pop app, here is our question. We're talking about the long-term effects of COVID-19. Have you been sick with the virus for months? Tell us about your experience and your questions. That's on Science Friday Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps. You can also say hi to us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or email us the old-fashioned way, scifry@sciencefriday.com. We really do want to hear from you. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow.